Any war is easier to get into than get out of, but history has repeatedly demonstrated that there are few quagmires quite so glutinous as Afghanistan. There are American veterans of Afghanistan who have waved their children off to serve on the same battlefield. 2021 marks 20 years since the United States led an invasion of Afghanistan to destroy Al-Qaeda, perpetrators of 9/11, and roust the Taliban, the Islamist government which harbored them. A peace process, largely conducted in Doha, has been underway a while, but the process has brought little peace. Last November was Afghanistan's worst month for civilian casualties in more than a decade. Former US President Donald Trump promised, nevertheless, to bring the troops home. The last 2,500 American soldiers would leave, he insisted, by this coming May the 1st. Interestingly, the new administration of President Joe Biden has not retracted this deadline. It is leaning hard on Afghanistan's government and the far-from-vanquished Taliban to agree a settlement. But is there seriously any settlement that the Taliban can be kept to if foreign troops leave? Is America preparing to settle for a defeat they can hope to sell as a draw? And where would that leave the people who live there? This is the Foreign Desk.
This is, in a way, an impossible decision, a very difficult choice for Biden. The impulse, in one sense, is to use this deadline to put a line over the Afghan conflict. But the reality is that the role of the Taliban and the presence of the Taliban in the country is a serious issue. And there's concerns here that the country would slide into civil war.
Those killing of women, civil society members, journalists, are all done to terrorize the people, silencing the voices of reason. It's a tactic to show that the gains of the past 20 years are not important.
These targeted killings means that people are terrified to go out in the morning. They say, without a hint of exaggeration, kiss your loved ones goodbye because you're not sure you're going to come home at the end of the day. Not a day goes by without a blast in some major city in Afghanistan. So they want this to work.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Suzanne Lynch and Lise Doucette. Suzanne Lynch is Washington, D.C. correspondent for the Irish Times, and Lise Doucette is the BBC's chief international correspondent. Suzanne, I'll start with you in Washington, D.C. This is very much not the first attempt the United States has made in the last 20 years to extricate itself from Afghanistan. What does the current plan, as we understand it, consist of?
Well, Joe Biden has inherited the previous administration's strategy on Afghanistan. And even though it's early days in the administration, the Secretary of State and the State Department here are saying that they are still sticking with that plan at the moment, and they're continuing the efforts as they see them that were made by the previous administration. So the special envoy, Khalilzad, is still there. He's been visiting Kabul and Doha as well. So they are now faced with this timetable that's looming. 1st of May has been set in stone, really, as the deadline for the withdrawal of US troops. That was set in the agreement that was agreed under Trump in February 2020. The idea now is that if troops are going to withdraw by that point, really around now, they would need to be putting those preparations in train. Now, as you mentioned there, Antony Blinken, the new Secretary of State, did write to the Afghan president in recent days, sending out a kind of a new drive to try and get some kind of agreement on this. And there are a number of elements to this. He's talked about power sharing arrangement. He's going to ask Turkey to host a senior high level meeting between the Taliban and the Afghan government in the coming weeks. And also talked about bringing other players in the region together, Russia, China, Pakistan, even Iran, in some kind of a high level diplomatic effort in this kind of drive to try and accelerate these talks that have pretty much been going on for a while but are not seeming to make much progress.
Lise, you are just back from Afghanistan, where, among other people, you spoke to President Ashraf Ghani. How excited, optimistic did he sound about this latest big idea of the United States?
How worried, how angry. I have to say that when I saw President Ashraf Ghani this time, he was in a much better mood than he was in October when I saw him. In other words, when President Trump was still in power. Now that the President Biden's team is firmly in the seat, he is, to use his words, delighted by the fact that they are talking to him more, trying to include him more. But it is also clear, abundantly clear, they also expect much more of him. And that was clearly set out, in fact, in a surprisingly blunt way, in the letter that was leaked from the US Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, where he actually said, "Let me be clear that when the United States pulls out its troops," and he made it clear they haven't made that decision yet, "even if we continue to give you financial assistance, we expect the security situation will deteriorate and the Taliban will make territorial gains. In other words, you better get with our program or you will completely lose power and lose everything in Kabul with the Taliban returning to power, which will not be good for Afghanistan if it happens in that way, and not good for the United States, which is trying really in these crucial months to arrange a departure which isn't humiliating or doesn't see them carrying out a repeat of Saigon with helicopters leaving the embassy in an ignominious defeat for the United States."
Suzanne, you were talking earlier about this May 1st deadline that was set by President Trump, but there is, of course, another deadline looming, deadline of sorts, which is the 20th anniversary this October of America's intervention in Afghanistan. Do you sense that there is a certain amount of determination by the Biden administration to get out before then, so it doesn't have to face an onslaught of questions about, we've been doing this for 20 years, what are we still doing?
You're right in that this is going to focus minds later in the year. This May 1st deadline is obviously much sooner than that. So I'm not sure how far it's going to play into public attitudes here. You know, Afghanistan is not really at the forefront of coverage in the US. It's there, but there's obviously a fatigue around the conflict there. So in terms of Biden and how he is thinking about this, I mean, the State Department was clear on the record this week saying, you know, we have not got to the point of a presidential decision on this, that the president is being briefed, but we're not at a decision point. But it's interesting to think about Biden. I mean, he's an experienced politician. He was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for many years. He was a vice president for 8 years. And he actually, we know on the record from various accounts, that he actually opposed a surge in troops in the early days of the Obama administration to try and deal with the Afghan issue. He parted ways with his president, President Obama, on this very issue. So, you know, Biden is not a warmongering president by any means. However, as Lise explained there, this is in a way an impossible decision, a very difficult choice for Biden. The impulse, in one sense, is to use this deadline to put a line over the Afghan conflict. But the reality is that the role of the Taliban and the presence of the Taliban in the country is a serious issue. And there's concerns here that the country would slide into civil war. And even though psychologically the idea of still having American troops there, there are fewer troops there. It's only 2,500, along with NATO troops, who, of course, are going to be watching closely what the Americans decide. But there are not, you know, it's this kind of sweet number where the presence of American troops is making a difference, but there are not that many American troops there. So in that sense, the feeling here, I think, is that maybe he won't stick to that first May withdrawal and that he will continue to keep those troops there after that date.
I mean, Lise, in Afghanistan, when you talk to politicians and other people about this looming deadline, does anybody take seriously the idea of power sharing with the Taliban, or even that the Taliban have been negotiating in good faith? Is it not the case that the Taliban basically think they're going to get the country back and they're just running out the clock?
Everybody, except for people who profit from the war, and this is quite a large number of people, but most Afghans are desperate for this war to end. Kabul was a very, very anxious place when I was there for 3 weeks. Far, far more anxious when I was there just 6 months ago. These targeted killings means that people are terrified to go out in the morning. They say, without a hint of exaggeration, kiss your loved ones goodbye because you're not sure you're going to come home at the end of the day. Not a day goes by without a blast in some major city in Afghanistan. So they want this to work. What they see now, and as Susanna's been talking about, they see the Biden administration in a way that wasn't so clear during the term of President Trump, is they're trying to accelerate this peace process so that the Taliban, who are now controlling or contesting 50-70% of the territory in Afghanistan, as you say, they are boasting on their social media propaganda that they have conquered a superpower in the same way the Mujahideen against the Soviets three decades ago. And they believe that victory is just a matter of time. The United States knows this, so it wants to do everything possible to see whether there can be a negotiated way out of this war instead of a collapse in Kabul and a potential civil war. And yes, to pick up on what you said, if you speak, I've been speaking constantly to the negotiators for the Afghan government in Doha, that for all the Taliban talk of peace, that when they get down and sit across the table from the representatives from Kabul, they basically say, well, you know, you're going to join us, not the other way around. You'll be lucky if we allow you to come and to live in Kabul. That we basically, what do you mean power sharing? We believe that we should be in power and that there should be a pure Islamic government. Now, that doesn't augur very well for so-called power sharing, but this is what the United States is trying to do. And I think this is what is worrying Afghans now. They feel that the Americans are trying to accomplish something very difficult and very dangerous in a very, very short time. It's good that it's accelerating because the talks in Doha were dragging on. It's good that they're sending tough messages to the Taliban because the violence is intensifying and much of it is blamed on the Taliban. And nobody wants the troops to stay on a day longer than necessary. But the question is, can it be done in the short time that is left? Something which would look like peace and last like peace for Afghans.
We'll talk more in the second part of the program about what Afghanistan's longer-term future might potentially look like. But just finally for this section, Suzanne, if we come back to the United States, is it basically fundamentally the case that America has reached the point of just wanting out of Afghanistan, and as long as it can get out without looking too bad or undignified doing it, it's not really that bothered about the consequences anymore?
I think the issue is that there is very little public coverage of the Afghan issue here. There are, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post are covering it. But, you know, your regular cable news, it's very consumed with domestic issues. In fact, Joe Biden has said he is consumed with domestic issues in his first 2 months in office. That's his focus. It's the COVID pandemic and his multi-trillion dollar relief package in Congress. But I think if Joe Biden feels that he needs to keep those troops there, I think he might be able to sell that to the American people. If he sets out those issues, at least sets them out, the realities on the ground, the confidence really of the Taliban here, I think many Americans may feel, look, you know, we can't walk away. Let's not forget, there was also outrage last time during the Trump administration when he was seen to have abandoned the Kurds. So Americans are sick of the war of Afghanistan, but I think Joe Biden will be able to sell keeping his troops there if needed.
I just wanted to point out, just to add to what Suzanne says, right now, 95% of the combat is done by Afghan forces. But what really makes the difference, for example, whether or not strategic provincial capitals stay in Afghan government hands or fall to the Taliban, is American air power, is American logistics, is American intelligence. That is what is really crucial, more than the actual troops on the ground. And Joe Biden, if you read President Obama's memoirs, has been absolutely consistent. And he said it in the election campaign. He would like a counterterrorism force, CT force, maybe 1,500 troops on the ground to protect the rest of their assets. But it's those critical things that make the difference between success or failure for the Afghan forces. Not to forget the fact that the United States pretty well pays for the entire Afghan army. And if the United States pulled out that money, the army could not survive.
Lisa Sett and Suzanne Lynch, thank you both for the moment. We'll have more from you later in the show. The Taliban's rule of Afghanistan in the 1990s and early 2000s was tough on everyone, but on Afghan women most of all. It seems unlikely that the Taliban's thinking on women's rights has evolved much since then, and current portents are discouraging. This week, Afghanistan's education ministry proposed to ban girls older than 12 from singing in public. I'm joined now by Belkis Ahmadi, Senior Program Officer at the United States Institute of Peace, with over 20 years of experience working in Afghanistan on issues related to gender, human rights, civil society development, rule of law, governance, and democracy. Belkis, I think a good place to start would be to try and assess the gains that Afghan women have made since 2001. Obviously, that is starting from about as low a point as there is in terms of women's rights. But what concrete improvements have there been for Afghan women in the last two decades?
Well, the list can go on and on. But if we are to look at different categories, I think first, there are laws, starting with the Constitution of Afghanistan, that protects women's rights and also treats men and women as equal citizens of the country. So first, the laws. Second, the institutions, such as the Independent Human Rights Commission and so many other commissions, Commission to Eliminate Violence Against Women, the Ministry of Women's Affairs, and all of that. There are policies and mechanisms put in place. For example, the National Action Plan for Women of Afghanistan, the plan to implement the resolution, UN Security Council Resolution 1325, and so on. The number of girls who have been able to go to school, the fact that there is no state-imposed dress code on women and girls, the fact that there are women journalists, entrepreneurs, judges, lawyers, prosecutors, I can go on and on. And when I mention these professions and professional women, keep in mind that during the time of the Taliban, there were none. The only sector that women were allowed to work was within the medical sector, with strict rules and regulations. And women could teach it in home schools. Obviously, most of them were hidden underground. So those are just some of the gains that women have made in the past 20 or so years.
So if we consider in that context this recent sequence of targeted assassinations of many women attempting to play some part in public life in Afghanistan, do you perceive in those killings a calculated attempt to roll those gains back?
Absolutely, absolutely. I believe that those killing of women, civil society members, journalists, they're all linked. And in my view, I think it's done to terrorize the people. The perpetrators plan to dominate by instilling fear, silencing the voices of reason, increase political chaos to spoil the peace process, and so on. But most importantly, it's a tactic to show that the gains of the past 20 years are not important. And we all know that they're still fragile and they can easily be eroded.
Do you get any sense that these crimes are being taken at all seriously by the Afghan institutions whose job theoretically is to protect, well, all Afghan citizens, but very much including Afghan women?
So after almost every attack, the palace, that's the government, and others in the Afghan government, after condemning the act and offering sympathy to the families of the victims, announced that there will be an investigation to find out exactly what happened. But so far, unfortunately, little has been revealed about the findings of those investigations. And it's heartbreaking, breaking for families who want an answer to the questions of who and why their family members and loved ones were targeted and killed.
Are you getting a sense that these killings are already having an inhibiting effect on women in Afghanistan, that they're becoming nervous about going to work or thinking of a future career or even leaving their homes? Are you hearing reports along those lines?
I do, unfortunately, and it's not only for women, because their being in Afghanistan also puts the lives of their loved ones and family members at risk. And I can tell you that now that we are all working virtually, a significant number of civil society actors are currently working from outside Afghanistan, and that's devastating. And let me also tell you that there has already been devastating impact on minorities, for example, the Afghan Sikh community. The majority of them have already left the country because they were being targeted by ISIS / Taliban because of their religion. In the views of the vast majority of Afghans, the reality is that ISIS is really not that much different from Taliban. I think that Taliban and ISIS are brands that are used interchangeably by the groups themselves and also by others.
Just lastly, if we focus particularly on the people we've been talking about, civil society, journalists, activists, how many of those people do you think are determined to see this all the way through, regardless of the dangers they may be facing? Or are you hearing from people that it's just too hard, it's too dangerous, and we're leaving?
Well, realistically speaking, knowing that Afghanistan has some 30 plus million population, and it's impossible for all those voices of reason to leave the country. There will definitely be a vast majority of civil society members who will continue to live and work in Afghanistan. And even those who have left Afghanistan, I'm hearing from them, it's temporary. They're still working for a peaceful Afghanistan to whatever sector that they are engaged in.
Belkis Ahmadi, thank you. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Lise Doucette and Suzanne Lynch. Lise, we were talking earlier in the show about your recent meeting with President Ashraf Ghani in Kabul. And we've been talking, obviously, about whether or not his government can still function without those 2,500 American troops and that total contingent of 10,000 foreign troops from 36 different countries. Realistically, and I don't know how realistic President Ghani is being, how far off is Afghanistan's government from being able to govern Afghanistan by itself?
Well, no president is going to say that I'm not capable of protecting my country. President Ghani did admit in a rare show of weakness that when I said to him, you know, right beyond these high walls of this fortress that you live and work in, people are dying every day. And he said, I can't protect every single individual. But there is a confidence verging on arrogance that the senior political and security advisors to the president believe that with their highly trained special forces, which police and army together are about 40,000, they think that they can hold on certainly to Kabul and maybe to some of the other critical capitals. And I think this is the message that the United States is trying to drive home, is that, you know, I've heard from advisors of the president, him saying, give me 2 more years. It'll be like Sri Lanka. We'll have a full military victory. And of course, the Taliban also believe that they can inflict a full military defeat on the government in Kabul. In fact, they call it the Kabul administration. So it's a classic situation, which is a nightmare for mediators, in which the two sides are talking about peace, but neither of them believe that they have lost the war, that there still isn't a fight. And that is why people are fearing that even though there's an accelerating peace process, or at least accelerating efforts to jumpstart that peace process, that this spring and summer could see the worst of all military offensives.
Just to follow that up, Lise, because this is, of course, a traditional almost part of the dynamic in Afghanistan. The sun comes out, the snows melt, and you have the annual spring offensive. But when you were talking not necessarily to Afghan politicians, but to Afghan people, what is it they think or anticipate is going to happen in the next few years? Is there a resignation to the idea that the Taliban will be back in charge and it'll be like the late 90s all over again? Or do people think that there is some cause for optimism?
Well, the danger this year is, you're absolutely right, the spring offensive, the fighting season is part of the calendar. It was interesting, I saw a post on Twitter from one of the Taliban supporters and he said, spring is coming. Now, most people posting about spring post flowers, the first green shoots. They posted a whole lineup of armored vehicles. So that's the kind of spring. This winter, there was hardly any snow, hardly any rain. And so the fighting never stopped. We went to the main police hospital in Kabul, and the doctors told us they had never seen so many casualties from so many parts of Afghanistan at this time of year. So Afghans are saying with trepidation, if the non-fighting season, so-called, was like that, what is the real fighting season going to be? And when you mention the 90s, when you ask people whether they're Americans or UN or Afghan politicians or warlords, you know, what is their main worry? Almost to a person, they say, is history repeating itself? They do not want another collapse into the chaos of the 90s when the Soviet troops departed, 1992 Kabul fell, Mujahideen took over, and there was a bloody civil war which paved the way for the Taliban. Everyone wants to avoid that. But of course, in this sort of in the determination to seize power, either on the battlefield or through negotiations, people may for the moment be blinded, you know, by the prospect of power being within their grasp. I think Afghans understand, and it's astonishing that 20 years after the US-led invasion toppled the Taliban, that the Taliban are now on the cusp of power, either through negotiations or through a military victory. One way or another, it's just a matter of time before they return to power. The big, big question is their Afghanness, is their commitment to a peaceful Afghanistan for all, the rights of women, the rights of minorities. They talk about that within Islam, but Afghans fear that that won't be enough, that the fragile gains, as they say, of the last 20 years will soon keep slipping away.
Suzanne, in the first part of the show, Lise invoked the spectre of the US withdrawal from Saigon, which was all terrifically undignified, terrified people queuing for the last chopper off the embassy roof as tanks smashed down the gates of the presidential palace and so forth. Were a similar scenario to unfold in Afghanistan, and it is sadly very far from impossible, How damaged would President Biden be by that? Would he be able to successfully say, look, this wasn't really my thing, it was something I inherited? Or would he be quite damaged quite early in his term by that kind of thing?
Well, I think he would be. I mean, foreign policy, famously in American politics, doesn't play any role in an election campaign, but you are judged by it once you're in office. So he is unlucky, some would say, that he's presented with this deadline of May the 1st, just a few months after he's taken up office. So I think what we're going to see maybe from the White House is more messaging on this. One thing to watch in the coming weeks, I think, is if this proposal by Blinken for a high-level meeting in Turkey between, you know, the Taliban and the Afghan government, if that was to happen, that could be something that, you know, gets us publicity. Maybe Blinken, he's just announced he's going to start traveling. He's traveling to Japan, South Korea next week, etc. You know, that would be a part of the White House kind of like putting this out there now as an issue that has to be solved and trying to get some public conversation going about it. You know, I do think that Biden will be able to appeal to Americans. I mean, this is part of his brand, that empathy. He will be able to appeal to American sense of duty, which, you know, we all know that for so many years here, Americans felt tired by the American incursions in the Middle East after September the 11th. Obama and Trump, in a way, were quite aligned in the sense that they both wanted to kind of get the troops out. But obviously doing that was just so difficult. So, you know, there would be a case to be made, I think, by Joe Biden that they have a moral imperative to keep some kind of interest in this country. But we just haven't seen that. There has been no messaging. I mean, the president has barely mentioned Afghanistan since he's been elected. He's left it very much still at the State Department level. He hasn't publicly commented on it. That may change in the next few weeks, and that might put more of the focus on this issue. But for the moment, there just isn't the focus at the moment here in the US.
Just as a final thought then, Lise, and again, when you're speaking both to Afghan politicians and Afghan people on your most recent visit, is there a sense that you know, vexatious though the relationship has frequently been, that they still feel like the United States owes their country something, that there's work here that still needs to be done by the outside world.
It's a very, very complicated issue. You know, as I said, none of us would want our country to be protected by another country's army. And the Afghans are a very proud, very dignified people. They would never have expected in 2001 that the Americans, NATO forces, there's now about 10,000 left altogether, would have to stay this long. In fact, some Afghans find it hard to understand, you know, to use the phrase that's used, how did the world's mightiest armies, why weren't they able to defeat fighters on motorcycles? I mean, how has it been that Afghanistan is where it is today? It's a very complex issue. Mistakes have been made on all sides. But I think the problem was that there's, as Suzanne would know, you know, we've heard so many different reasons why the United States and Britain and the rest of the world came to Afghanistan. We know that they came for their own security interests, and they emphasize this now. Their only real interest in Afghanistan now is to protect the United States of America, to stop Afghanistan from becoming a safe haven again so that Al-Qaeda can carry out attacks on the scale of a 9/11 attack. But on the other hand, you do hear from Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan about women's rights, about human rights, about broader issues. And you hear, you know, Afghan women sort of saying, well, can you just leave us like this? Didn't you say that when you came to Afghanistan that you wanted to roll back all of the restrictions of the Taliban? So they do feel that there's a broader interest in making Afghanistan not just a safe place, but a place which allows women and minorities to have a place so that they don't start, you know, trying to be smuggled across borders to seek refuge. So I think they do believe that the United States and other world powers have the ability to put more pressure on both the Afghan government and the Taliban, and they could do it for what are not just Afghan goals, but their universal human rights, certainly in 2021, about allowing people to live with dignity and to achieve their full potential.
Lise Doucette and Suzanne Lynch, thank you both very much for joining us. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Yolene Goffin and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.